Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Bookish. My guest this week is my beloved friend, Nancy Baker Cahill. Regular listeners will know that I've talked about her endlessly because she introduced me to half the people on this podcast. She is my soul sister, one of my dearest friends. LA's unimaginable without her. She's the friend that you text in the middle of the night and who actually texts back. We share recipes and sleep remedies and book recommendations and pretty much everything. And it was so fun to get the chance to sit down for an hour and just dive deep into books. We share books and talk about books a lot, but not to this degree. And it was so lovely to get the opportunity to do it. What's even nicer of Nancy is that we had to do it twice, because the first time, halfway through, not even three quarters of the way through the first interview, my laptop died. And by died, I mean went black. And we were 45 minutes in to talking about all her books. And not a minute of it was saved, which was just heartbreaking. And she was her traditionally hilarious and delightful self and laughed it off and said, "So fun, we get to meet again." So we did. We met a week later. And we drank beer and we did it all over again. And you know what's fun is we didn't repeat it. It's not the same podcast. It's a different one. And I feel like we explored different avenues and went down different paths. And it just goes to show what a great friend and great person she is, that she was willing to do that. Nancy is a visual artist who is gifted with graphite pencil as she is with her virtual reality gear that she works with. She makes extraordinary works of art that you can actually climb into. You can have them on your phone. Twitter followers of mine will know that the Fourth Wall app is something that I love and have on my phone, and I project crazy bits of art all over the world, and then you get to climb into it. I really recommend it. It's fun, it's extraordinary, and it's kind of groundbreaking. It really is. Anyway, here's me and Nancy talking about art and books and how they intersect. And I know you're going to love her as much as I do. Okay, the first thing that needs saying is that this is not the first time we have done this. And Nancy, thank you from the bottom of my heart for doing my podcast for the second time.
I would do it 10 times.
Okay.
I might switch up my books a little.
Don't even fucking say it, because God forbid. Okay, so just to clarify for those of you listening at home, I'm not even going to drag you through the just mortifying bonfire of the vanities that was the first time we tried this. Suffice to say that Nancy has thoroughly rehearsed this podcast and it didn't record. So, my massive fuck up, and luckily is not only the most talented artist I know, but also the most generous friend I have. And here we are again, this time not in Nancy's studio, but in Nancy's lovely house, sipping a beer, maybe we're not. It's water, guess what, you'll never know.
Maybe it's my favorite beer.
Sparkling water. And here we are again, but we're not even going to, you know what we're going to do? We're going to ignore the fact that we did it before.
Yeah.
We're not even going to try and recreate that.
No.
Because that was its own thing.
I don't even know what I said.
Special private thing just for us.
I've already forgotten. Exactly. I just remember laughing really hard.
We did laugh really hard. So we're going to start this over. You just handed me a book that is not one of your five.
Yes.
And I just want you to tell me about it. Is this what you're reading right now?
Yes. And I sort of wish it was one of my five.
Because
it's one of those moments. Yeah.
Okay. So the book I'm holding is called Dawn of the New Everything. It is by Jaron Lanier.
Yes. I think that's how you pronounce it.
The subtitle is Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality. So I'm just going to say right off the bat, no wonder this is right up your alley. Because Nancy is an extraordinary visual artist whose current forays are into
virtual reality and augmented reality. But she's also, you know, an incredible just artist with charcoal and all the rest of it. The Fourth Wall app is something that Twitter followers of mine will know is something I love deeply. It's the most awesome app that you can use and climb into her drawings and project them into wherever you are and virtually walk through her studio. It's so fun and it's so groundbreaking and so extraordinary to get up close to your work like that. So,
thank you so much.
No surprise.
Generous introduction.
No, not at all. So no surprise that the book that I'm looking at is about virtual reality. Tell me, how did you find it?
Oh, I am so lucky. I had this wonderful conversation with a man named John Bulett. I hope I'm not butchering his name as well. He's a journalist, a tech journalist for Refinery 29.
Yeah.
And we were just having this amazing conversation. He said, well, surely you've read this book. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, I haven't. And he said, well, you need to get your hands on it because it aligns almost exactly with everything we're talking about and everything you're saying.
Right.
And so, you know, being like you, voracious mm-hmm. around new material and new books, I just immediately bought it. And instantly I realized, oh, this one belongs with The Art of Cruelty, it belongs with Aftermath, it belongs mm-hmm. with those, that incredibly rare genre of book which blends the intensely personal mm-hmm. with the philosophical, mm-hmm. and in this case, with the technical,
right.
which generally, you know, might feel inaccessible to people, especially because he's clearly a math genius. Oh, I mean, his story is absolutely fascinating. But it is, I literally haven't been able to put it down. It's partly why I was up at 2 a.m. I could not put it down.
The reviews are amazing. I mean, New York Times says daring, original, terrifically inviting. New York Times also says lucid, powerful and persuasive, poetic and prophetic, say the Times of London. Okay, I'm sold. Tell me why,
you would love it.
Why, if I know nothing about VR as I do, other than the times that I have climbed into your work, why will I like it?
Okay, well, first of all, you'll love it because he's an extraordinary storyteller. Mm. And his voice is irresistibly... He's one of those people that's so smart that he's humble about his... He has a tremendous humility about his intelligence. Mm-hmm. I think probably because he's so open-minded, which to me is such a mark of real intelligence and curiosity. He's capable of awe. He expresses awe.
Is he talking about the applications of the dawn of the new everything? Pretty wide. Is it the applications of VR just in the artistic world or in every world?
Fascinatingly, he's one of the basically founders of VR. So he kind of got there first in the 80s. So he goes back to the 80s. But when you learn about his personal history, it all starts to make sense. For example, he lost his mother very early on. I think he was 13 years old when his mother was the breadwinner. His father was able to afford, I think, either on a teacher's salary or he hadn't even gotten a job yet, a tract of land in New Mexico. Not a sort of hard scrabble tract of land mm-hmm. surrounded by mobile homes and that sort of thing. And they lived in tents for 2 years. And he basically said to his son, while we're living in tents, design the house we're going to live in.
Oh, wow.
And to his 13-year-old son. And he did. He said, we'll build it. And they did. And it's a series of geodomes, basically, that they lived in. So unconventional from the start, but arguably presaged his appreciation for VR, for these sort of transcendent spaces. Mm. And what's interesting about the way he talks about VR and the reason why it's so compelling to me is because he really has this humanistic angle that's sort of reductive, but he talks about the sort of, he fully acknowledges the dark applications, the sort of ways in which it will be and is being abused.
Like what?
Well, there's a theory, I think it's called, I'm going to butcher it, I think it's called Skinner's Box,
uh-huh.
and which is a philosophical, around the time, I think post-war, there were like the Milgram experiment, there were all these sort of Pavlovian, all these sort of behavioral experiments.
Mm-hmm.
And Skinner, I believe, experimented on animals, but the idea was that you would put an animal in a box and the animal would think that it had choice. You, in fact, were controlling everything the animal did at all times.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. You can apply that to porn, military, anything you want. But in his case, You know, he's really interested in the expansive potential of VR, in the artistic potential of VR. He's really interested in haptics and sound, all these extrasensory sort of all the transcendent potential. And to be fair, I'm only halfway through it. So, but as you can see, it's already marked, underlined, dog-eared. I've scribbled notes. I'm having a conversation with him without even talking to him.
You've talked to me before about VR as being a means of extending or widening the capacity for empathy.
Yes.
Which I'm always really, really struck by. That, for example, I think you talked to me once, or maybe I heard you doing another podcast once, where you talked about the possibility of, like, stepping into a Syrian refugee camp through VR.
Yes.
And actually, rather than what a two-minute experience of that does just sensorially to the body, to consciousness, rather than a 40-page in-depth New York Times magazine article, right?
100%.
And what that is, and we all know what that is. We all know what it is to go to a movie as opposed to reading a book. I mean, there's a reason the visual world coexists along with the written word. You know, they rival each other in their different ways. But it's really interesting to me that the idea that VR, just that VR has that capacity, because that to me puts it in the same realm as literature. I believe literature is the elastic that makes us widen and grow as human beings and continue to experience other things, to stand in other people's shoes. VR literally puts you in other people's shoes. Like, there's a really interesting correlation between the two.
I think that's such a fascinating connection, which I would never have made prior to this, you're absolutely brilliant, and that's true. Yes, I mean, that's a whole segment of VR called immersive journalism.
Right.
And that's really the context I first learned about it 20 years ago, not even in the 80s, but 20 years ago when I was an undergraduate. You know, I think that you can still, but I think it can be applied perhaps more abstractly, and in my case, I hope poetically through art. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I love is that, like literature, especially if you don't dwell too much, this is just my opinion.
Yeah.
If you don't dwell too much, if you offer extrasensory information, in other words, not just visual information, but extrasensory information, you are able, I think, and hope to elicit a truly individual response to the work.
Right.
In other words, it's not pre-gamed for you.
Right.
As it is in gaming, and that it's not Skinner's box. Actually,
right.
It's the opposite of Skinner's box.
Right.
Well, up to a point. I mean, that could be argued actually vigorously, but I agree with you, because it's sort of why we all have our, you know, we're also possessive of our favorite books, the way we imagine them in our heads, right? They exist there. And I think what we're really talking about is a different kind of consciousness and memory. And that's also what's going on. You know, the founder of VR, well, one of the other founders, Chris Milk, said, you know, that in VR, your consciousness is the medium. Arguably, the same is true when you read a book.
Right.
Right, you're engaging with your consciousness, your unconscious, and your subconscious as you fill in the blanks that aren't provided for you.
Yeah.
Which is why sometimes when we see books made into movies, of course,
it's so devastating.
It's devastating.
And I think it creates more polemic than just about any other adaptation. I mean, all adaptations, I think, create more polemics than normal, straightforward, original works.
Absolutely.
Because we do have all our own versions of what Howard's End looks like, or Game of Thrones, or, you know, whatever, Emma. Whoever it is, they are ours when they're ours.
When they're ours, yeah, exactly. I felt that, and as much as I love Gregory Peck, I felt that way watching To Kill a Mockingbird. I thought, oh, this isn't how I pictured it at all.
Oh, that's so interesting. So that was your first book.
That was my first book.
First book, lovely segue. Harper Lee, 1960, it was published. Gregory Peck was not how you'd pictured it.
No.
That's so interesting.
I mean, he's a wonderful Atticus, but that's not how I pictured Atticus.
So how old were you when you read it, and how old were you when you saw the movie?
Because it was the 70s and it was the era of benign neglect, I'm sure I read it inappropriately young. I think I was probably around 8 or 9.
And do you know who gave it to you?
I found it on the bookshelf.
Really?
as I found all things.
Oh,
just
really?
Found it on the bookshelf.
Right, okay.
I think I was around that age.
Golly, that's young.
Yeah, totally. I think it was, I was a precocious reader.
Yeah.
Anything I could get my hands on.
No, I'm with you, totally.
Very quickly dispensed with, you know.
My mum claims that the first thing I learned to read was the Renault 5 handbook, because she spent talk about benign neglect. I was left alone in the car, in a parked car, around Fulham and Chelsea in London, while my mum went out to lunch. She's an excellent mother, I hasten to add. Mom, if you're listening, I love you and all of you.
I love her too.
But I spent a lot of time sitting in the front of a parked car in the 70s. I'm going to assume with a cracked window and with nothing to entertain me.
Sure.
Other than the handbook that came with the Renault 5 that we drove. And my mum would come back to find me.
Changing a tyre.
If only anything so useful. But just sort of looking up blankly as I turned to page 48.
It's like this
of
feels,
the chassis description.
It's a little, I want to say it's a little dry. It's like a bit dull. I can't follow the narrative all that well, but it's available.
So as a precocious, there's a fellow precocious reader at this table is all I'm saying. Yeah. It's a miracle I'm not a mechanic.
Yeah.
But here we are doing my podcast. So you think you read it aged maybe 8 or 9, yeah. And then when do you think you saw the movie?
Much later. I saw the movie far, and I remember it was one of those things where I'm sure my father was like, you should see this movie, it's a classic, whatever. But I'd read it several times by then, so I had a very calcified, in a way. I mean, it was evergreen in the sense that I always got something new out of it, but I really... I pictured the street the same way, pictured the chicken wire ham costume the same way, I pictured Boo Radley's house the same way. Everything about it I pictured the same way.
Right.
You know?
Did you identify with Scout? Was it the vigorous sense of social justice that I know and love in you so
well? Yes.
Is that what it was?
I think so. I think... Thank you. That's very generous as well. I think I loved the fact that she was a girl like me who was not a conventional girl. Mm. Wasn't, you know, her best friend. She worshipped her older brother. I didn't have an older brother, but she, you know, Dill and her brother were her whole world. Mm. And I just loved the fact that she was intrepid and way too articulate, let's be fair, for a six-year-old. I mean, in her narrative
sure.
voice. And seeing this whole... very, very adult story unfold through a child's eyes. It just, as a point of access, to me, it makes the story available to every reader at every age, you know?
Yeah.
Certainly as an adult, you read it slightly differently. There are things that are over your head when you read it at that age. But it's the one book which I've told you well, it's not the only book, but it's one of the books I have read to each one of my kids at a certain time in their life.
You
word
read
for
it
word.
Entirely.
Entirely.
To all three.
Yes.
That's
but at different
wonderful.
Times, and
yeah.
not all at once.
Yeah. As an audiobook, did you ever, or did you just read it to
No, no, out loud.
Out loud.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Voices, as you can imagine, you know.
What?
Not as much fun with To Kill a Mockingbird because it's serious, but Confederacy of Dunces, same thing.
Oh,
just
yeah,
the voices.
That.
And
yeah.
that I would read to them in a group, just because.
My
you know.
God, Confederacy of Dunces, that's massive.
No, but not the whole book, just segments that were especially hilarious. I didn't mean to jump forward.
No,
I'm just
that's
saying,
fine.
In terms of just reading aloud, I had somebody, and this is probably 10 years, this is probably dates me 10 years or something, but at some point someone said that it's important to read out loud to your kids. That's probably since been disproven. I don't really care one way or the other.
No, not at all. It's now so clinical that they say if you can, I mean, literally, you know, people are out in the world advocating for young teen mums and things, saying if nothing else, if you do nothing with your children, can you read to them for 15 minutes a day?
Right?
So it's not only been, you know, you're not dating yourself.
Okay.
If anything, you were, you know, they were ahead of the time, and now they are absolutely categorical about this. That reading aloud to your children is. If you do that and nothing else, you have given them bonding, you have given them social skills, you have given them emotional closeness, because odds are that child has had to be in your lap in order to read to them, so there is literally a physical closeness. It's quiet, volume is guaranteed to be down, like way transcending just basic literacy skills. There is blanking on the word, but there is an emotional connection that's happening between mother and child that they say this reading aloud combines and sort of coalesces all these different things that are absolutely essential for early learning and early development. I mean, literally development of the brain. So congratulations on winning.
I never got an award. I don't know if I can.
Your award is your awesome children. But tell me why. What makes To Kill a Mockingbird formative in the sense of how do you feel like that moment or the reading of that or the rereading of it shaped you? How is that in your DNA, do you think?
I think because, well, first of all, it's a story that takes place in the South. And the South, I was raised in Boston, but my entire family on both sides was Southern in root. And so I always felt a sort of like I was an expat from the South. It was something a badge I wore with pride as a teenager, and I've since become had a more complicated interest in it. Yeah. But I think the story felt as fresh and relevant then as it does now, mm-hmm. more so even, mm-hmm. that there is and always has been systemic racial injustice. I mean, not to just,
sure.
you know, use a phrase that's used now a lot, but I wanted them to understand that you could fight for what was right and still lose, and that it was still important to fight for it.
Yeah.
And I found the class issues really fascinating.
Even this at that young an age.
Oh, well, at that, okay, well, it, no. Okay, at that age, I'm sure I was obsessed mostly with just the injustice of it.
Yeah.
It's just not fair.
Yeah.
It's that child, that cri de coeur, it's not fair.
Yeah.
And it's not fair.
No, that's true. And that's what the book is.
Yeah. And I think it also, I loved the scenes in the courtroom. I found them electrifying even then. The drama, the sheer drama of it. Mm-hmm. And then the sort of ways in which they were personally imperiled. I mean, she was imperiled when she was in the costume.
Yes.
But also that's the sort of the ghost of Boo Radley, which... Yeah. How could that not ignite a child's imagination when, you know, at least, well, I should speak for myself. I grew up in a house that was over 300 years old. And as we know,
we all know what's living in it.
Yeah, we won't talk about that. but I think that sort of eerie unknown, well, and for, I mean, obviously it's not a spoiler alert, but that kind of, that you're faced with your own judgment in the process, that you too judge and misjudge. Mm. And it's not necessarily that you're being racist in that moment, but you're certainly assuming someone is up to something or doing something wrong, and they turn out to be heroic. Mm. And so, I don't know, I loved all those inherent contradictions. Mm. And, I mean, at the end of the day, it's just an extraordinarily well-told story, but it had all this substance. It was so substantive.
Did I ask you the last time, and I forget if I did, well, either way, we didn't get it on tape. Did you read... Tell a Watchman.
You did ask me, and I said
go
I did
set
not.
A Watchman.
Yeah, go, or you could ask him too.
Yeah.
I did not. I did not because.
Because you didn't want to.
I didn't want to.
Because it's one of your five formative books.
And I revere that book. Mm-hmm. And I didn't. It's sort of, you know, like when you meet sometimes an author that you just worship mm-hmm. in real life, or an artist, or somebody else, a politician, anybody that you've held in such high esteem. And then, I don't know, I just didn't want anything to pollute that, the purity of that love.
You didn't miss anything. It was, I read it out of curiosity because I loved To Kill a Mockingbird, but it wasn't formative for me in that way. But I revered it. But I, in a funny way, I didn't have so much reverence that I couldn't read Ghost Set a Watchman. And it was completely other. It's a completely other experience. They're older, and it's a different Atticus. It's not so similar that you feel like there needs to be a compare and contrast. It feels like a completely, completely separate novel. But you're good. You don't need to read it. I read it for you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I won't.
Let's talk about your next book. I was thrilled to see this one. The book you gave me was Inferno by Dante Alighieri, which is part of the Divine Comedy.
Yes.
And it was written sometime in the 14th century. This is so fucking impressive that this is one of your books.
No, it's impressive because it's maybe the only... It represents both an enormous failure on my part and sort of my grandest passion. Just a little history. I read it in... I went to high school, as you know, in Brookline with your husband.
With my husband.
And many of our friends. And I was in AP European Literature. I was a terrible student. And this book... Like, you know when this happens, your brain lights up, right? It was a lit.
Yeah.
The minute I started reading and they were at the dark, again, back to Boo Radley, like, they're standing in front of the woods.
Yeah.
What's going to happen? Mm-hmm. I have to know. And I just cherished every canto, every descent, every circle they made, the people they met, the things they experienced. I was like... This is a fascinating hell. And I was also confused and frustrated by it because, as I said before, you know, when you grow up in a sort of Judeo-Christian tradition, well, it gets back to that justice issue. I couldn't square with the fact that, you know, a rapist or a murderer would be at a higher level than someone in the pit in the icy pit with Lucifer.
Because who is in the icy pit?
Well, the person at the icy pit is the person who has affected the most. I mean, it was obviously very political for the time.
Sure.
The person who has destroyed the most lives through their actions.
So it's numerical.
Yes.
You get the more people you hurt, the deeper you go.
I believe so. Right. And if there are any Dante scholars listening, and I'm wrong. I'm sorry. That's how I remember it.
An addendum. If you're a Dante scholar, please let me know. I'd love to have you as a guest on the show. Anyway, carry on.
You can show me up. But I found it so creative. I thought it was just so... I kind of loved the punitive and the sort of the hopelessness that coexisted with the fact that we knew at the end of the day, Virgil was really a guide and he was taking Dante down. Dante says to Virgil in the beginning, you know, I don't want to go. And this place stinks. It's gross. There's all these disgusting farting demons. Like, get me out of here. And that's the paraphrase. And
no, that's true. That's verbatim. That's Nancy quoting.
I'm just quoting the original Italian. And he says, Virgil says, no, you can't, because he's like, I want to go to paradise. And he says, no, you can't do that until you have gone to the deepest pit.
Right. And then you can go.
Right. And as a metaphor, I just found that very compelling. I think that's true.
I do.
I think that's what rock bottom's all about.
Yes, indeed.
And so I found that very compelling as an idea. And the reason it was a massive failure was because I thought my very eccentric teacher would find it charming if I, instead of a final paper, submitted actually an etching, a drawing of frozen skulls in hell, and that I was
how
mistaken.
Did that not win you a scholarship? That sounds fucking brilliant to me.
No,
he
I
did not,
got a C
there.
Plus.
You got a C plus?
I got a C plus, yeah.
No way.
Yeah, and he handed me a copy of Strunk and White and basically was like, get started. It's a little late, but get started. So, but I just, over the years, my son right now is all equally obsessed with the book.
How old? Which son?
Luke. Mm-hmm. He's 17. Yeah. He knows far more than I do, as he's...
And what was his introduction to it? Through you?
Well, he's always heard me talk about it, but he's actually opted to take a class specifically devoted, an entire semester devoted to the Inferno.
How interesting. Is it a literature class?
Or yes.
Is it
100%. So he's really, you know...
Immersed,
truly immersed in it. Exactly.
In the Divine Comedy or in just into the in Inferno?
I believe it's the... Whoa, I'm going to get this wrong. I think it's just the Inferno.
Whoa.
And here's the other thing I loved about it, and this also may or may not be true to scholars listening, but I was told that the Inferno was written in sort of either, I would say, vernacular Italian, street Italian.
Sure.
There was a lot of, like, quote-unquote foul language.
Yeah.
That Purgatorio was sort of everyday speech. And then, of course, Paradiso was written in this incredibly sort of elevated prose.
Yeah.
And I just also thought that, I want to be with the guttural. Again, it's like, I want to be in that dark space and
so
listening and looking and learning. But with that thread of...
It's reminding me of Shakespeare, who wrote all his, street characters, his grave diggers, his gatekeepers, his all the, nurse.
Working
all
people.
Exactly. All the working people speak in prose. Mm-hmm. And everyone else speaks in iambic pentameter. Or the higher up you go. The higher up you go in the social structure of Shakespeare. So
right.
So the more elevated your speech becomes. But, it's so glorious both on the page and when you see a play. It's so wonderful, the difference and the juxtaposition of, the guards on the opening of Hamlet saying who goes there and what noise is this, and then you go into sort of Hamlet's extraordinary proper iambic pentameter and all of that prose. It's just such an interesting thing, and I'm sure Dante had a hand in that because Inferno was such an important text to Shakespeare.
Well, it's conceptual.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a core. It's conceptual choice, which is a really important one. It just underscores, the exigency that he's trying to put forward.
Do you... was that the first last time you illustrated a book, as it were?
Well, I think it was the first and last. I think that was my... my maiden voyage that ended in
just
drowning.
But no, but I'm interested because there's so much of the Inferno that's so visceral, as well as being political and sometimes dry and slightly listy in my experience of it, my memory of it. Instead of listing of, you know, completely specific, slightly recondite Italian political dastardly people of the time.
Right, who we don't know who they are.
Exactly. Yeah. But it is visceral in the experience of it, in the sensorial time that we spend down in the pits of hell. Your work is so visceral and so emotional and so, and I'm talking just about the drawings here, forget even the immersiveness of your VR, but your charcoal, it's like watching bodies being pulled apart. Your body almost gets pulled apart in the experience of looking at one of your drawings. I'm wondering if there is an element of the struggle of Inferno, or the need to emerge from it, or the need to go into the bottom of hell and then come up through the top. I'm wondering if it, consciously or not, informs how you draw, what you draw, how your approach to drawing is.
Incredibly perceptive, and it's 100% true. In fact, I had a whole series that I called Virgil for precisely that reason. I really trusted, well, I guess I was trusting myself. Mm-hmm. I was trusting my own intuitive impulses, and I trusted the paper and the graphite to sort of lead me where it would. And that
so the graphite was, sorry, I would keep saying charcoal.
No, everybody thinks it's charcoal because I use the literally like the darkest graphite possible.
Right.
I've never used a light graphite to save my life.
So your graphite was Virgil?
My graphite drawings were Virgil,
amazing.
Because I thought, I have to trust this guide. I have to trust that...
Where it's taking you.
Where it will take me, and it may be a combination of all things.
Yeah.
It may have... That contradiction may inhere in, and I hope it does, in those forms, because if it's just bleak or despairing or sad, it to me, that's not a place I want to spend time.
Sure.
And there's less texture.
Mm-hmm.
When you introduce the tension of escape, struggle, then you're dealing with something that's very human and I think relatable to most people.
Right. Will you make sure that we have the link to the Virgil drawings so that when we put this on the website, you can click and see the drawings as well?
Yes, absolutely,
okay.
100%.
That's what I want. I'm excited to talk about this third book because your third book, The Art of Cruelty, A Reckoning by Maggie Nelson, published in 2012. This is one of the first books that you ever recommended to me. And Nancy,
you were like, who is this crazy person?
No,
that just befriended.
I was just so thrilled. First of all, anyone who recommends me books that I've never heard of is just thrilling to
or
me.
That you've never read, which would be a miracle.
Well, no, not
that's
that I've
the
never
challenge.
Read. But also just authors that I've just never, ever heard of. It's like handing me a whole cake and then closing the door, which shows you how much I love food. but it really does. It's just glorious. And I knew we were kindred. I knew when Davey introduced us that you were going to become my friend and no longer his, which let's just face it, is the case there. I've said it. It's on the podcast now.
It's
official.
Stamped.
But this was it was unsurprising and made me smile when I saw this on your list. So tell those who don't know who Maggie Nelson is what this wonderful manifesto is about. Why The Art of Cruelty? What is in a paragraph?
Oh God.
What is the what is her thesis?
Well,
if you can.
I don't know that I can even reduce it or do it any justice. I will say just from the outset that she is a prolific writer. She is one of my favorite writers. She's one of the, and she may in fact be the only writer I've ever written an actual letter of gratitude and appreciation, gratitude to and appreciation for. And you're not supposed to end. I know from Strunk and White, you don't end a sentence with
a dangling what if I
miss
for.
But she, this particular, so I've read almost everything she's written, almost everything. And each book, this is a recent influence. So each book has played a different role. For example, her book Bluettes has a passage that inspired a VR drawing and a whole other series of drawings around that.
Mm-hmm.
This is very sort of simulacrum-y, but it was a Gertrude Stein poem that she was talking about. And I took sort of both the Gertrude Stein, the seed of the Gertrude Stein poem, as interpreted by Maggie Nelson, as the foundation of that, that series. But this book in particular, as you can see, it's just, I mean, it's just disgusting what I've done to it.
That is a passionately loved book that we're looking at here. This is underlined, underscored with different pens, which means it's been read multiple times. And it looks like my books at Oxford used to look when I had to write a thesis about them. And you've never written a thesis about this. So what is it about her? What is it about this book? What is it? What
communicates it? It's so funny that you just... This is literally what we just discussed. So I just opened it up to this page.
Read it.
And she says, she says, true enough, but if the cruelty in Troki were simply a reiteration of the amorality and nihilism of a junkie's universe, it would be a bore. Troki's cruelty is of a more metaphysical variety. It is the cruelty of leading himself and the reader through passage after passage of compelling philosophical rumination and psychological insight, then snapping us back to nasty animal need, to score, to fuck, to flee, to forget, which is always standing by to nullify mind and heart.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
So who's Troki?
Scottish writer.
Oh, okay.
He wrote a book called Cain's Book in 1960.
I see. But what she's saying, if I get this right, what her point is, how does the artist involve us in cruelty in a work of art that might have violence in it? And then yet without perpetuating a pathology of cruelty.
So what she goes on to say is that is the inexorable cruel struggle of being enthralled to a substance, especially one that alleviates pain as at the same time that it causes it. And I think that's if there's a thesis at all to me, it's that, you know, cruelty in art for cruelty's sake is, well, for one thing, as I said before, boring.
Yeah.
But it also can do damage.
Right.
If you instead allow it to coexist with either countervailing forces, not in a binary way, but if you allow it to be textured and nuanced, mm-hmm. you can, I mean, she talks about this theoretical idea of a neutral. If you can occupy that neutral space where things can come and go and shift in and out, you know,
you, the viewer, have agency, where you have a choice about how you're experiencing that.
For one thing,
work of art?
Yes, right. Or what you're given, what you're offered.
Right.
Of course, you can always choose to throw a book against the wall, which is one of the questions I love that you ask. You always have the choice to turn away.
Yes.
But in terms of making art that addresses some of the crueler points of life, the unfairness mm-hmm. of it, mm-hmm. you know, the lack of justice. How do you, and to my mind, it's actually a way of, it's a conversation starter. How do you engage someone in dialogue if you either, one, are merely didactic,
right.
or tell them it's one way,
right.
or you say, it's all dark.
Right.
It's the end of the conversation.
Yeah.
It's not a conversation.
Right.
If you instead engage curiosity, if you instead offer alternate points of view, or mm-hmm. you...
Suspend judgment.
Yes. Or if you allow... Again, countervailing forces to coexist
right.
in a state of unsettled tension mm-hmm. that becomes porous mm-hmm. in a way that allows different people of different backgrounds in and out. And you can grapple with it, I think, in a more, again, back to humanism, in a more humanistic way, mm-hmm. in a more honest way, in a more authentic way, than if you are... It's one of the reasons why I just don't... I'm so turned off by didactics of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be told how to do something, what to do.
Or what to think about something.
What to think about something.
Right.
And even Jaron Lanier talks about how science is endlessly unanswerable.
Right.
And anyone who says that we've answered something is lying.
Hmm.
And I would say that that's not her point per se, but it's something that I really think about in making work. And that's why this is inspiring to me, that you can, and also sort of coming to grips with the fact that you might be drawn to The Inferno or Boo Radley or whatever, but there might also be more to it than that.
Right.
And it's not, I don't know, she actually, in a funny way, I think, and in the most generous way possible, frees you from judgment I mean, she's incredible.
Frees you, the artist, from the responsibility of judgment, or frees the experience? Right.
And I think that it is a reckoning, of course, but it's a very generous reckoning. Mm-hmm. And she is incisive beyond words, mm-hmm. as you know. Mm-hmm. Nobody wields the yes. pen
more like, ferociously.
More, yes. exactly. I mean, yeah. there's not a word is spared that doesn't need to be there. And she's funny, and she's abject, and she's dirty, and she's... I mean, I don't know if you read her... you read her essay on Prince. I think it was yes. in... I mean, it's just...
Yes.
No, how could that ever be?
Yeah.
Nobody could ever do it better.
Guys, find the essay on yeah. Prince. And if I can, if I remember, I will put it in...
It's in the New Yorker.
Yeah.
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 Oh, it's extraordinary. I believe it's in the New Yorker. So, I just said that with a lot of authority. As my father always says, seldom right, never in doubt. which goes back to didactics. So, I clearly am merely reacting to myself. But, yeah, no, I think that this is really... Oh, she again, here, she's quoting Patti Smith. In art and dream, you may proceed with abandon. In life, may you proceed with balance and stealth.
Hmm.
You know, it's that...
But it's such an interesting thing, because I more and more as we're talking, I'm realizing this. You are saying the same thing about art that we all agree is what makes great literature. It's just so interesting to sort of extend it wider into the visual field as well, because the greats of literature, I think, are the ones whose compassion is so boundless that their willingness to stand in the shoes of absolutely fucking anyone, look at Adam Johnson in Fortune Smiles, choosing to step into the shoes of a paedophile
yes.
and tell a story from that point of view, the most heinous, reviled figure in society,
mm-hmm.
and choose willingly to stand in those shoes and tell us a story from his point of view. And as a parent, but you don't have to be a parent, but as a parent, it was one of the most difficult things I've ever, ever willingly read. I put it down twice and then I came back to it because the skill was so extraordinary, the temerity, and then the absolute execution of it was just so breathtaking.
Everything he does is...
Everything is extraordinary that he touches and in such diverse ways. But my point is that I think what's interesting, and I'm sort of extrapolating as I speak, is that Maggie Nelson and he are sort of talking about the same thing, which is you have to stand in a neutral space, and from that space, you can tell any story.
Yes.
But you cannot be in judgment in the telling of it. You cannot decide your point of view. As an actor, I relate. I can play the most heinous villain imaginable. But I, Sonia, have to believe that this person has a point of view, a place to stand in, a reason they're behaving like they are.
Absolutely.
I have to give them the backstory that justifies how they've arrived at this villainous frame of mind. Because if I arrive with judgment, then I give the audience nowhere to go and no story to tell and nothing of their own to supply. And as an author, the great authors are the ones who say, I'm going to stand in these shoes and I'm going to let you decide. You see what yes. you see. I will offer what I can. And it's interesting because we think of as... I don't know. I think of literature as offering words, offering being... both reified things that denote certain things. And yet, we all agree that none of us is reading the same book. We're Mm-mm. all having our own experience of that book.
Exactly.
So how real are these words? How reified are they really? And by the same token, art, this visual medium, this much more slippery, hard to pin down, hard to denote, hard to know what it is, medium is... in its same way saying, I offer you this, view it as you choose, come to it. But I have to stand in one fixed place in order to tell this story.
And in that fixed place, you not only have to be 100% authentic, which is to say, if you are giving voice to something that perhaps you may have shame around or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you, again, as you just said much more eloquently, can't be in judgment about it
mm-hmm.
because other people won't relate to it.
Right.
And they will smell it.
Yeah.
They will smell it.
I'm thinking about that exhibition you took me to see when we went to the Hammer.
Radical Women.
Radical Women, which was wonderful. And I'm so glad you took me. I have not forgotten it. I referenced you doing a text message the other day about a piece of work of yours. But it was, I'm going to bastardize this, but it was Latin American women from all countries in America in South America rather, and I think it was from the 60s, 70s. There was a specific time.
I can't remember the exact decade span, but yes, it wasn't.
Put it this way, yeah. Most of Latin America was under the thumb of a dictatorship of some sort during that era.
And the bravery.
Women more than any, and add to dictatorship Catholicism, and you've got, and machismo, which is just endemic down there, you've got a seriously oppressed underclass. And it was work just produced by these women. And it was so clamorous. It was so loud. Some of it was so obnoxious and in your face and too much. And some of it was so harrowingly brilliant, unforgettable. But the unforgettable stuff was the stuff that stepped this extraordinary middle line of saying, here, I offer you this, but I'm not going to show you me being raped by six paramilitary, but I'm going to offer you...
But I might show you the hole where I laid after it happened.
The hole where I laid, exactly.
The ambiguity of that.
Right.
It's exactly right. It all comes back to this idea of ambiguity, not... As a means of being inarticulate,
no,
not and not ambivalent,
no,
but ambiguous,
yeah,
as essential with, as you said, that incredible compassion and, in my opinion, courage to tell a story,
yeah,
or to resist, or to, I mean, many of those women took their own lives,
right?
Well, no, they put their lives in grave danger,
right.
by making the work that they did,
right,
and or had to do it anonymously or whatever, you know. They're doing it for exactly the right reasons.
Yeah. The stakes should be that high, though, to write.
Yeah.
You know, you should write as though your life were depending on it, and you should paint, too.
Annie Dillard, another person I love and who I learned about through Maggie Nelson.
Who was her teacher, right?
I think she was your teacher, and she also, by the way, dedicates Art of Cruelty to Annie Dillard. She says,
taught by Annie Dillard at Wesleyan.
Oh, perfect. So she says, for Annie Dillard, who advises otherwise. What a great dedication.
That's a good
But of course,
dedication.
When I read, it was clear Annie Dillard was important to her, so I went and got The Abundance, which I also, we read, which we loved.
Yeah.
That is another book, and it's not on my list, but in that book, she says when she's talking about, she's referencing Thoreau and as a writer that you need to know your own, it's actually the whole essay, it's a essay on writing.
Yeah.
She says you have to know your own bone.
Yes.
Gnaw it, dig it up, and then gnaw it again.
Yeah.
You know your bone, go back to it. And she says something, now I'll totally mangle it, but it's something like, what would you say to a dying person that would not enrage them? Mm. And that should be, back to the stakes idea, that's
what you should
write
for.
If you have a story, guess what? If you read To Kill a Mockingbird before you die, you're not going to feel enraged.
Yeah.
You're going to feel lucky and grateful that you got to read that book before you died.
It's a great, I'm going to write that one down since I've started writing so hard. I'm going to write that one down. What would you say to a dying person that would not enrage them?
Yeah.
Well, those really are. That's a great way.
And she says you were set here to give voice to your own astonishment.
Yeah.
Which all of these writers are giving voice to their own astonishment.
Yeah.
As are you, as, you know, anyone who does that.
Yeah. Let's talk about your next book, Confederacy of Dances by John Kennedy Toole, which was published in 1980, posthumously, years after he wrote it, 10 years after his suicide.
Oh.
I love the backstory of this, which anyone who knows the book knows, but for those of you who don't, John Kennedy Toole lived with his mother and was... a thwarted writer. This was the only book he wrote, and he committed suicide, and his mother would not give up on getting this published and relentlessly sent it absolutely everywhere, and eventually took it to Tulane University, because they lived in New Orleans, which is where the book's set, and Walker Percy happened to be professor of English literature there at the time. Walker Percy had just won the National Book Award for The Moviegoer, which is a beautiful book that I know.
Which I just bought.
Literally just bought.
Yeah.
And Walker Percy read it because he just was being bullied by a bereft mother and couldn't put it down. And then between them, they got it published, which is just a lovely indication.
And then it won the Pulitzer.
And then it won the Pulitzer.
Yeah.
Oh, just that.
Yeah, just that. I believe that it did, yeah.
Tell me when you read it.
I read it again as a young adult. I read it after college. I read it, actually, my husband always talked about it, and as one of his favorite books. And the shared trait I have with all of the people close to me is a intolerance for earnestness.
Yes.
So immediately, and I was raised, one of my best friend really growing up was my grandfather, who was the most irreverent person I've ever known. And he was a flawed person in other ways. He was from the South, but he was the most irreverent person. And so I grew up, and my mother too, is just wildly irreverent. Mm. So I grew up with, well, that was a priority. And uh-huh. A bias, let's call it.
Continues to be.
And I picked up this book and I thought, where have you been my entire life?
Wow.
Ignatius Reilly.
Wow.
Where have you been? And I, as I said to you before, I just talk about writing yourself into the text. I mean, I became Ignatius. I felt like Ignatius. I still feel like Ignatius. It's like today I was Ignatius.
I love that this pencil-thin woman in front of me thinks that Ignatius Reilly, this depressive, enormous, chaotic slob.
It's very gassy.
It's wonderful.
He's just always railing against the world. But I feel that's what I relate to is his you know, he too, the experience, he's quite judgmental, actually.
Yes.
He's so judgmental.
Yes.
He's fiercely judgmental, which I have to confess I am too. I mean, I've memorized certain passages from that book. When I encounter certain works of art, I want to say them out loud and I don't. But he's also desperate and he's railing against the world and what he perceives to be, you know, his own victimhood. But he has a real moral sense of justice. And so and he's wildly articulate. Mm-hmm. And he's a disaster. He's just a walking disaster. I mean, you know, he's just unemployable. He's always screaming about his pyloric valve, you know, and offending people, and you know, he's just the ultimate misfit. And I think
maybe you felt like a misfit.
I still do. I mean, I think most artists on some level do. But he just, I don't know, he was so vivid to me. And for the longest time, I remember actually looking at the illustrations and feeling frustrated with them because, again,
right.
You know,
it wasn't what he looked
like. No, my Ignatius doesn't have disgusting sort of. They made his lips look like hot dogs. They're just disgusting, right? And then he has that horrible sort of brush, you know, broom mustache, yeah. And then the hat and the thing. He's really, really grotesque.
In my head, I just have to say, Walker Percy described him so beautifully, so I have to just
please
offer this
just
quote.
Purge.
He described him as a slob extraordinary, a mad Oliver Hardy, mm-hmm. a fat Don Quixote, a perverse Thomas Aquinas,
yes.
rolled into one.
Yes.
For me, and I haven't read it very recently, but I, you know, put it in the last 10 years. For me, he is completely fused with the lead character of that wonderful podcast, S-Town. He's John B. Latimer to me. He is that
tragic and brilliant.
Tragic, brilliant philosopher convinced of his own ingenuity.
Outraged by everything.
Outraged by everything. Maverick. Persona and ego, but somehow deserves them at the same time, even though they are grossly inflated. Like, there's something, to me, they have melded. Now, of course, I'll go and reread The Confederacy of Dunces and realize, oh, no, wait, they're completely, completely
no,
different.
But
in my brain,
something.
There's something
yes.
southern and eccentric and unique
yes.
about both of these people that the Eastern Seaboard does not produce, and nor does the granola-fed California coastline.
No, because there's so much color and flavor and irrepressible. Well, it's that outrage again, but they're never dull.
Yeah.
That's the thing. They
yeah.
don't commit the sin of dullness
yeah.
or earnestness.
Yeah.
And his letters to Myrna the Minx are at times pornographic. I mean, they're amazing.
Yeah.
And I mean, that is one of the first, that book, and I would say Foreskin's Lament, which I also highly recommend, by Shalom Auslander.
I read that at work. I read that at work. I read that on season 2 of The Catch, and I can't tell you how many crew walked past and raised a serious fucking eyebrow. It got so bad that I was like, listen, it's comic, listen, it's really funny. They're sort of short, it's autobiographical. Fuck it, I'm just going to read it in my trailer. I cannot face explaining to one more person
why I'm laughing.
Why the title.
And here again, we have someone railing against his culture, his tradition, God.
Yeah.
But those two made me laugh so hard, I literally cried. And I think when you can make someone laugh on paper.
Yeah, to rest.
What a feat.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, I just wept with laughter.
Yeah.
Throughout the entire book.
Let's talk about your last one, because that one just made both of us weep with laughter. Your last book is Tattoos on the Heart, The Power of Boundless Compassion by Father Greg Boyle. This was published in 2010.
Yeah, also recent.
So I read this again, thanks to you. I still live in the hope, because I'm emailing with his office weekly, that we get him on the podcast. Father Greg Boyle, just for those who don't know, is this extraordinary Jesuit priest who began, who started working at the church downtown and created Homeboy Industries, which is the collection now of companies that will help get gang members who want to leave the gangs out off the streets and into gainful employment. It began as a tattoo removal parlor because the extremely prominent, largely facial tattoos that these gangs had meant that they were walking into job agencies or, you know, any sort of job opportunity and being written off before they'd even opened their mouths. So the tattoo removal parlor became this genuine, practical way to strip them, rid them of some of this identity, and then start training them up. It's now Homeboy Industries has a bakery, a catering company, a mechanic, a dry cleaning company. I mean, they have completely proliferated and exploded, and all thanks to this extraordinary man. So I offer that just by way of some background on who this this modern day saint really is. Tell me how you got to him or the book or how did it arrive in your life?
I had a friend who was a board member, and at the time I had been sort of circling around, you know, lots of things compete for our attention. I had always been interested. I'd heard an NPR story on him.
Yeah.
I'd always thought, well, this is somebody who's really, this is a priest. I am admittedly skeptical of organized religion, but here's a priest who is doing the work.
Yes.
He's rolling up his sleeves. He's doing the work.
Yeah.
So I'm interested.
Yeah.
And I loved just the idea of what he was doing. Anyway, they had had this fundraising crisis, and the friend said, come to my house. You'll meet Greg, Father Greg, or G as they call him, but don't come without a checkbook. And I thought, as I usually do, I try and do my research. So I got the book. I bought the book, which he signed for me that day.
Oh, wow.
Certainly meeting him was the clincher, but even prior to that, I knew I actually didn't even have a choice. It's one of those things. I read the book, and at one point he talks about, again, he's a radical, okay? It's radical in the way that I imagine the figure of Christ was a radical.
Sure.
Which is what makes, you know, these ridiculous self-avowed Christians, they wouldn't have anything to do with Christ.
Right.
If he showed up on their doorstep.
Right.
They wouldn't recognize him.
No.
He was a radical.
Yeah.
Okay, he didn't want to hang out with people like them. But anyway, first of all, this is a book, again, that made me laugh as much as it made me sob with compassion and with, because of his compassion.
Mm.
In other words, he did that thing that you talked about. He puts you in his authenticity, allows you to experience these sort of universal truths that are so, so different from a lot of our experience, right?
He allows you to experience them by being so unbelievably specific.
Yes.
I mean, that's why what I find so extraordinary about the book is he's talking, they are chapters and they may as well just be a series of homilies or sermons that he's given. But they take a story or three from a gang member, and, you know, ranging from falling in love with a lovely guy who then is gunned down in the street 3 months later to going into prisons and speaking to young guys who are in there but desperate to get out and promise that they will come and find Father G and eventually do or don't.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found so moving about the book, because I went off and read it as soon as I saw it on your list, what I found so moving about the book was that they couldn't be more specific and further from my very white privileged experience.
Precisely.
And yet the message that he's offering and extrapolating, but without hammering you with it in this gifted way, because he is a literature major as well as a Jesuit priest, is the universality of what's happening.
Yes.
That what's making these gang members is their sense of isolation, their sense that they are already rejected by society. So fuck it, if they're this liminal, who cares what their actions are?
Yeah.
And his point is, he says we should get this printed on t-shirts. You can't disappoint us enough.
Yeah,
that's the sort of motto. You can fuck up and come back and come back and come back at Homeboy. They will never ever shut the door on you, because God will never ever shut the door on you.
Yeah.
And the wider implication of that was what I found so beautiful, the idea that we continually reject ourselves, those of us that don't embrace an organized religion, but reject and push away these parts of ourselves that we don't like, that we'd rather not you know, that we'd rather not own, the, I don't know, the lazy part, or our ambition because it's so unseemly to own it, or our weight, or our failure at parenting, or whatever these parts of ourselves that we would rather not own. And his message to me is so transcendent, which is, You keep opening your arms and you bring that piece to lie down with you, and that piece, like, own the whole of you, or you are not whole, or you are incomplete.
Well, and that's what the definition of boundless compassion. And he says no matter whatness, the no matter whatness of it.
Right.
But the thing that really got me by the throat was this passage where he talks about people judging poor people, which happens.
Do you have it, Mark?
Let me see if I can find it. I'm sure I marked it, but he talks about judgment, and which I think you hear a lot, especially today. You know, why don't they pull themselves up by their boot? Anybody who's spent any time in a community that is as disadvantaged as gang communities are knows that's not, it's not that someone hasn't pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. Right. The odds are stacked
against
them on, again, back to systemic racial, social injustice, all these things. But anyway, he says, rather than judging the poor, this is it, I found it.
Oh, good.
Here's what we seek, a compassion that can stand in awe at what the poor have to carry, rather than stand in judgment at how they carry it.
Mm.
And that's the thing. That's at the heart of it.
Yeah.
You stand in awe at what they have to carry versus how they carry it. Mm. And that, it's subtle and it's delicate, but that switch, if more people practice that, and it's easy not to practice, it's so much easier just to judge.
Mm.
We would have such a different society, and we wouldn't have the kind of disparity we have, and we wouldn't have the violence, and we wouldn't have so much of what's wrong right now. And so I felt this just literally spoke right to my heart.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to put it. I mean, it just literally was like it reached out from the page, grabbed me by the heart, and was like, okay, I'm not letting go until you show up.
Yeah.
So I did. I showed up and I said, I have this crazy idea for an art collaboration. I'm probably deluding myself that you'd even be interested, but what do you think? And he just immediately, of course, come into my office. We'll talk about it. Let's make it happen.
And what did you do? Tell us what you did.
At the time, I had a series I was doing of about violence and beauty and coexisting at once. Mm-hmm. And it was called Bullet Blossoms. And I would shoot my paintings.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would paint blossoms around the bullet holes that sort of exit wounds. And we ended up calling the class Exit Wounds.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a collaboration where I encouraged a lot of these formerly incarcerated, wonderful people to tell their stories through collage any way they felt comfortable. Many of them were very practiced artists. Many of them weren't.
Mm.
Didn't matter. That's the great democratic benefit of collage.
Sure.
There's no right or wrong. And then I would say to them, okay, you tell me where you want me to place the shot, and I will shoot it there. And then you tell me what kind of blossom you want me to paint around it, and I will paint it there. And we had a show of these works. So I really was just a technician. I didn't have any, I was just helping. I mean, obviously that was
not going to be. You executed the entire thing.
I was there really to encourage. And we ended up having a show in a space, an artist-run space down by Skid Row. And it got all this press. And everyone was able for the first time to see literally their work celebrated, sold. All the proceeds went back to Homeboy Industries. It was sort of my attempt at because I couldn't give, I couldn't write a big check, but I could help raise money through art.
Yeah.
So that's sort of how I did it.
So inspiring. Well, such an inspiring story. That
they changed my
beautiful.
Life. They changed my life. They changed my life, and I have to say, it remains. It's one of those things that I can't even talk about it. It just meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And always will. I'm dying to go back, actually. I'd love to do a VR project. I've actually talked to him about doing that.
Have you?
And I just haven't. Yeah, we too have been struggling to get. He's a very busy man. He's in great demand.
Very hard.
But yeah, no, it was very, just deeply, deeply meaningful.
Mm.
Very. I was very lucky to be a part of it. Mm. Very lucky to meet the people I did. And I learned so much.
Mm.
And I went in thinking one thing and, you know, came out changed.
Yeah.
And entirely. And it wasn't even that I went in with any hubris. I went in with no hubris. I just went in open, but thinking, oh, well, this is going to go this way. And it didn't go that way at all.
Mm.
It was extraordinary.
Mm. That's the best possible experience.
Oh, yeah.
And the best possible outcome of his book. I mean, I just did a podcast with my friend Piers Tordy, who's a novelist, and he, in our first 5 minutes, sort of made my hair stand on end, where he just in passing said something like, well, every novel is a call to action.
Mm.
And I stopped him and asked him to expand on that. So your listeners, you can find it in that podcast because we won't go into it twice. But I've been really pondering that. I've been really thinking about that's such an interesting point of view. It's such an interesting point of entry. It's such an interesting way to pick up any book. What is this book inviting of me? What, but not just imaginatively, where is it asking me to go? Mm. But morally, emotionally, what is its imperative? What is it demanding of me? How is it asking my worldview to change in any small or large way? And his is so unequivocal in what he's asking.
Oh, yeah.
It really is. And
well, this is a kind of preaching that doesn't feel like preaching.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't feel didactic.
Yeah.
It feels open.
Yeah.
But it is, if nothing else, a huge call to action.
Yeah.
I mean, and so is the second book, the follow-up book,
yeah,
which we also just read.
Yeah.
But I think that's a really great, that it made me, I just flashed to the scene in Anna Karenina when they're in the mushrooms, they're in the forest and they're trying to connect, and this, I can't even remember the characters'
names. Levin and Kitty?
And it wasn't Levin and Kitty, it was like, they were like, not sub-characters, but they were like, they were supporting,
supporting characters.
Yes. Sorry, it's terrible. And they had been trying to get together for months and months, and they had engaged in this sort of Howard Zinn sort of flirtation that went, you know, it was just unfulfilled and unconsummated.
Yes.
And they finally have their chance alone in the forest and searching for truffles or something. And there's a moment where they could actually, if not consummate, acknowledge that this was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the moment ineffably passes, and it's clear to them in that moment that it'll never come back.
That's right.
And so that exquisite detail, calling someone to pay attention, it's literally to pay attention,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
If not a call to action, it's like, pay attention.
Yeah.
Open your eyes to this.
Notice. Yeah.
Consider looking at this.
Yeah.
Or consider this.
Yeah. I have a last question.
Yes.
You can take one book to your desert island.
Oh, God.
It can be one of these. It can be something quite different. What is it?
This is such a tough one. This is a real cop-out of an answer, I have to say. But I think it would be the thing I would need to feed me.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be a survey of art.
Mm.
It would almost have to be, textbooks are fraught with, it would have to be, it's a book that doesn't exist, basically.
Okay.
Because they've all been written, and they've written many people out of the textbooks,
uh-huh,
who belong in the textbooks.
Sure.
So it doesn't exist. But if I could design my own textbook.
You absolutely can.
Okay, that's what I would bring.
A comprehensive survey.
Yes.
With visual and biography in there.
Yes,
well.
And story and background and maybe some philosophy thrown in and history. And
Nance, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm smelling a book. I feel like you need to curate this book immediately.
I'll get crucified for it. I'll do something wrong, I'm
the
sure.
The book you want to take to the desert island.
Well,
that seems like what Annie Dillard would tell you to do.
She would. Book. She would say, give voice to your astonishment.
Yes.
So I would choose the things that astonish me.
Yeah.
And I am fortunately, I'm so lucky to live in the city where I am constantly astonished by a variety and a plurality of voices, but also historically, I think there's so much, there's endless amounts to be astonished by, and to learn from.
Well, thank you for doing my podcast for the second time. This was so fun. And can I tell you all, so different to the first one and so juicy, and just goes to show what a brilliant mind and artist you are, that we didn't replicate it word for word. We really didn't.
No, we didn't.
We had a completely different conversation and a better one. Thank you so
much. Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for this podcast.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's interview. If you like the show, please write us a review on iTunes, on the website. It really makes a difference. Rate us, give us some stars, let your friends know, let your family know, tell everyone you can. Go to the website, bookishwithsonyawalger.com, if you want to find out about any of the books that you heard about. We list there not only the 5 favorites, but every single book that is referenced. You can also buy the books through the website, and we make a tiny, tiny little percentage of whatever you buy through the website. So if you are interested, please go ahead and click on that. You can find us on Facebook. We have a Bookish with Sonia Wolga page. You can find us on Twitter with at Bookish Sonia or at soniawolga.com. And you could also email me through the info@bookishwithsoniawolga.com page. If you hit on contact, it'll just automatically pop up as an email there. So if you have any ideas for guests that you'd like to hear from or thoughts that you have about the show, please don't hesitate to share them there. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the show.